KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in East Oakland.
I live in Richmond.
Lake Merritt.
I live in North Oakland.
Berkeley, California.
Coming up, why our state's forests actually need more fire, not less.
In California, smoky skies were the norm, historically.
Then he's a public defender and a son of incarcerated radicals. Today, he's running to be San Francisco's next top cop.
A lifetime of going through steel gates and getting searched by prison guards just to see my parents taught me about how dysfunctional our criminal justice system is, about how it's failing victims.
And we'll go to one of the best smelling spots in San Francisco.
The Princess Anne has like all the scent. You can smell it just walking by. Go give it a whiff.
Stopping to smell the roses today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. Here in the Bay Area, we're all bracing ourselves for the possibility of another big fire. In the last 5 years, California had the most deadly fires in its history. So far, it's luckily been a relatively quiet fire season. But up in the Sierra Nevada, there's a fire chief who says for those forests, they actually need more fire. KALW's science reporter Marissa Ortega Welch brings us the story of this maverick fire chief.
You would think managing a wildfire would involve trying to contain the flames, but it can actually involve starting fire.
The challenge will be to keep up with these guys. These are hotshots. They're some of the elite firefighters.
Taro Pusina is the fire chief for the Inyo National Forest in the Eastern Sierra. He's my guide today at this wildfire. It was started by lightning 2 weeks ago, but now this hotshot crew is managing it, even actively adding flame to the ground to push it along.
They're very good at igniting and then also at fighting fire.
They're walking around the forest with drip torches, fuel cans with flames on the nozzle. As they pour a little bit of fuel under the bottom of each tree,
it shoots out little bits of flame onto the forest floor.
Don't think backdraft. It's mostly just pine needles burning and some lower tree branches here and there. But then a pile of fallen sticks under a tree catches fire and shoots flames up the trunk. Then the entire tree is on fire. I'm laughing, but I'm nervous.
You're getting the full effect now, smoke and everything.
The crew could have easily put this fire out.
And I've done much of that. We all have. We show up on scene, it's one tree burning. You cut the tree down, you spray some water on it. It's done. You're done that day. You go home and you never have to even think about it again. That's the short-sighted view.
The long-term view is managing wildfires, letting them burn and run their natural course if they don't pose a hazard. Because Pusina says fire is a normal and healthy part of California's forests. And he wants to spread this gospel to whoever will listen. I talk with Kristen Shive, science director for Save the Redwoods League in San Francisco.
I know that guy, and I think he is rightfully a zealot on this issue. It's just like we have our only way out of our fire problem is with fire.
Shive says California used to have way more wildfires, and Native Americans used to light fires to manage the forests.
What I think is really important to understand is that in California, smoky skies were the norm historically.
But when Europeans arrived, they killed or kicked Native Americans off their land and suppressed the wildfires. So even though it seems like the last couple of years have had a lot of fires,
we're still in a fire deficit. What's really shifted is the type of fire that we're getting.
When the forests don't have regular fire, all the stuff that would burn, like fallen trees and brush, builds up and becomes fuel. They're like matchsticks waiting for a match. And then when something like a lightning storm comes along, boom, instead of a whole bunch of small fires, we get one severe fire. Whole swaths of trees burn down that were habitat for birds and other animals.
So it's no longer necessarily sort of a healthy natural process, but it's really something that's fundamentally changing the system when fire does occur.
If all the trees in a big area burn down, the seeds can't disperse and grow.
It's true, something will grow back after one of these severe fires, but it may not be forest.
Fire ecologists have known for a long time that fire can be good for the environment. And national forests and parks have policies in place that encourage managing for healthy wildfires. But still, most lightning-started fires in California just get put out immediately. A lot of fire managers see them as too risky. Because all fire, even a well-managed one, has some risk. Fire Chief Taro Pusina and a handful of others are shouldering that risk. They're managing lightning-started wildfires in remote areas to do what they believe is the best for forests ecologically. Like this fire we're at today.
We are going to what's left of the lightning strike tree that started this fire about almost 2 weeks ago now.
Right after the fire started, Pusina got together a bunch of specialists at the Forest Service.
Wildlife biologists, we have forest archaeologists, we have hydrologists.
They used computer modeling to predict where the fire would spread and the smoke would blow. They looked at how it might impact roads and towns, cultural resources like a Native American historical site, natural resources like a sensitive bird species nest. One of the things they had going for them this year was it was an extremely wet winter, so the chances of the fire getting out of control were less likely. And because it hadn't been a busy fire season, there were crews available to manage it.
So we have to weigh all of these values and take them into consideration.
And they decided that this wildfire was a good candidate to be managed instead of put out. But fire makes smoke. Residents in the nearby towns have to breathe it. If it gets too smoky, tourists won't visit. That impacts local businesses. There are people who would prefer that Pusina had just put out this fire. But he has a message for them.
Smoke and wildfires are part of California's fabric. They always have been. They always will be. So I ask people that choose to live in California to figure out how they are going to come to terms with that. But no smoke and no fire is simply not an option.
He wants Californians to prepare for more smoke in our wildlands, but hopefully also healthier forests. For Cross Currents, I'm Marissa Ortega Welch in the Sierra Nevada.
Marissa is KALW's science reporter. You can email her at science@kalw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Let's turn to politics now. Chesa Boudin is running to be San Francisco's next district attorney, and he's got a very interesting history. When he was just 14 months old, his parents were arrested for participating in an armored car robbery that resulted in three deaths. That began a lifetime of involvement in the justice system, first as a young person visiting his parents in prison, then as a public defender, an advocate for reform. Chesa Boudin is now running on a platform of sweeping change, including reducing racial bias, defending immigrants from deportation, and ending mass incarceration. He spoke with KALW Justice reporter Holly J. McDeed.
So you're the only candidate that has experience as a public defender, but you're also the only candidate who doesn't have significant experience as a prosecutor. What makes that an asset? What do you see as an asset in that?
I've done more than two dozen jury trials in front of San Francisco juries. I'm the only candidate who currently works in San Francisco's Hall of Justice. So I have relationships with all of the stakeholders on the ground, the sheriff's department, the police department, the district attorney's office, the public defender's office, the judges, the juries, the people accused of committing crimes, and the communities that are impacted by it.
Well, you've also been able to enact some sweeping change as a public defender when it comes to bail reform. You're able to make changes in that role. What makes you want to switch and work for the DA's office? Why do you feel like you can make a bigger difference there?
Well, one of the things that sets me apart from the other candidates is not just being a public defender. It's that my parents were incarcerated when I was a kid. And I spent my whole childhood and still to this day visit my parents in prison. My dad is still incarcerated. I started advocating for criminal justice reform when I was in grade school. I've continued fighting for change through my time at Yale and at Oxford on a Rhodes Scholarship. I became a San Francisco public defender because I wanted to make sure that people who were too poor to pay for a lawyer had access to equal justice. After years of doing impact litigation work on immigration, fighting against ICE, on money bail, on other areas, as a public defender, I saw that the changes were unbelievably slow to reach the day-to-day practice in the court. And part of that is there's a culture at the Hall of Justice that needs to change. We need to transform our approach to public safety. And the best way to do that is as district attorney.
And as someone who has had parents who have been incarcerated, could you talk a little bit about how that has shaped your view of the justice system? Do you feel like in that case your parents were failed by the justice system? What did it teach you?
I'm in the majority of Americans. Literally, the majority of Americans in this day and age have an immediate family member who is either currently or formerly incarcerated. That's what mass incarceration means. And a lifetime of going through steel gates and getting searched by prison guards just to see my parents, just to be able to give them a hug, taught me really hard lessons about how dysfunctional our criminal justice system is, about how it's failing victims, about how it's failing to rehabilitate people who commit crimes, and about how it's failing to invest in communities in ways that prevent crime. Right now, district attorney's offices across the country and in San Francisco use victims as evidence to secure convictions and send people who've committed crimes to prison. I want to have an approach where we actually listen to victims, give them a voice, keep them informed, and empower them to guide the process towards healing the harm that they've suffered through restorative justice.
The district attorney's office has gotten a lot of criticism over the years for how they handle sexual assault cases. Few of those cases are actually prosecuted, though they say it's still above the national average, so it's a problem around the country. What will you do to help victims of sexual assault find justice and people be prosecuted in these cases?
There's a couple things we need to do, and the first is to recognize that sexual assault is probably the single category of crime that's the most common serious crime and yet the least reported. We need to change that. Now, one of the reasons why people don't report being sexually assaulted, being raped, is because when they have the courage to come forward and to submit their bodies to invasive evidentiary gathering procedures, all too often, law enforcement doesn't even bother to test the rape kits. In fact, one of the other candidates in this race and the police commission in the city are defendants in a lawsuit for refusing to test rape kits, refusing to accept outside grant money that would have paid for a private forensic lab to test the rape kits that had been gathered, new and old. It's a disgrace. It's humiliating. So one of my first, simplest, most basic commitments to everybody who submits their body to a rape kit collection process is we will test that kit. New or old, we will test every rape kit in this city. The other thing we're going to do is involve lawyers from the district attorney's office in sexual assault investigations from the very beginning. And we need to do that so that it's not just up to an individual officer making a credibility determination about whether they believe or don't believe a victim.
Yeah, and you also want to dramatically reduce the county's jail population. Could you talk a little bit about your plans to do that?
County Jail Number 4, which is one part of the broader San Francisco County Jail, is on the top of the Hall of Justice. It's a seismically unsafe building. It has daily sewage floods. The city's being sued, multiple lawsuits, as a result of the unsanitary conditions. And if there's an earthquake, everybody in that jail, the inmates, the people who live there, as well as the sheriff's deputies and civilian staff that work there, could die. 80% of the people in jail are awaiting trial. They have not been convicted of a crime. 65% of people we put in jail in San Francisco will be there for a week or less. We're dealing with people who are cycling in and out. When I'm district attorney, I'm committed to making every single arrest an opportunity for intervention and transforming lives away from crime. If we're doing that effectively, then when people are in jail for 2 or 3 days, we can pair them with the services and the supports that they need in a way that keeps our community safe and prevents them from getting rearrested. About 20% of people in San Francisco County Jail have money bail that they cannot afford. And that means that a judge has decided they're safe to be released with one condition, a financial condition, that if they're wealthy, it's fine for them to leave jail and go back to their community. But because they're not wealthy, they're stuck in jail. Monetary conditions on liberty are discriminatory. They undermine public safety, and I've dedicated much of the last 4 years to fighting against them. When I'm district attorney, we will never allow our assistant district attorneys to ask for money bail, to put a price tag on freedom, because people who are too dangerous to be released should be detained, and people who can safely be released with appropriate conditions should be released with those conditions if they're presumed innocent.
That was candidate for San Francisco District Attorney Chesa Boudin speaking with KALW's justice reporter Holly J. McDeed. We'll be speaking with all the DA candidates this week on Cross Currents, so stay tuned. This is Cross Currents. I'm Henat Baba. Sheer elegance, wild blue yonder, Lady Elsie May, Daybreaker. Although these might sound like romance novel titles, they're actually names for different species of the flower of romance, the rose. San Francisco's Golden Gate Park has one whole acre of land dedicated to roses. In this story from our archives, reporter Chris Hambrick follows the scent.
This is an oasis of color and smell. It's popular among tourists and honeybees, too. Fuchsia, red, peach, yellow, and white blooms explode everywhere around me. Andy Stone, the Rose Garden supervisor, tells me more.
The Rose Garden is divided into 64 beds, each with a different variety of rose, usually 12 roses to a bed. And then there's the beds on the side that have the climbers and the old-fashioned roses.
The garden's been around since 1961. That's when the American Rose Society's San Francisco chapter went looking for a space to test different varieties in a cool, moist climate. Most of the roses here are hybrids that have been donated. Before we get going on our tour, I have to ask.
What's so special about roses?
They are the queen of the flowers. They're just one of the most beautiful flowers of the garden.
We stroll across the lush lawn to get to know some of these beauties a little better. Stone stops at one of his favorites.
So this one is Julia Child, and this type of rose is called a floribunda. It has many, many flowers on each spike, and they're somewhat fragrant, but what I like most is that they bloom so heavily. They bloom very heavily, they have very healthy leaves, they're not affected by very many pests.
Oh, it smells fantastic. What color would you call that? I'm saying yellow, but it's more complex than that.
Oh, it's gold. It's a golden color. It's kind of buttery. Julia liked so much butter on everything, so this, I think of Julia's buttery chicken with this one.
Speaking of butter, I noticed the other roses that remind me of food, like the cherry parfait. It's a white rose with red-edged petals, while the rainbow sorbet is a golden flower with red-orange blush on the tips. For our next stop, Stone takes us to the area where climbing roses wind around lattice borders.
This is a very old rose called Rosa eglantine, and that would be grown in England on the old castles or in Ireland growing up over the castles, and it grows quite tall. I'd almost like to let it go up and climb up the redwood trees. This one here is a briar rose, and it makes nice big rose hips, and these are sometimes actually used for jam.
This one looks like tissue paper. What's that one?
That's another briar rose. And it's this simple old-fashioned rose, just one row of petals, five petals.
I leave Stone to do some of my own nosing around.
Whoa. The wild blue yonder has the distinct rose smell that I love. That one might be my favorite because of the smell. Strike it rich. Oh, this one is really tall. I think it's probably called Strike It Rich because it's super gold.
I see someone with clippers. It's Stephen Childers. He's the rose gardener. And of course, he has his favorite.
Princess Anne is the second one from the front. It's a purple, older English variety of rose with a really great scent. And that's one of the reasons why I like it so much.
Surprisingly, not all roses have a scent. And during hybridization, it can fade as growers focus on taller, hardier plants.
The newer roses have a really showy display, but there's no scent to them. And that, for me, kind of takes away part of what makes a rose so cool, is the fragrance of it. So the Princess Anne has the nice double-double flower, and it has, like, all the scent. You can smell it just walking by. So that's my favorite.
Oh.
Go give it a whiff.
I smell everything I can, and the wonderful ones twice.
Polka, iceberg.
For Cross Currents, I'm Chris Hambrick, smelling the roses.
The Golden Gate Park Rose Garden is open all year long. Find all the information about it at our website, kalw.org. And while you're there, don't forget to subscribe to the Cross Currents newsletter. And let's wrap it up with some Bay Area music. This is Stranger Than Fact from Oakland. They're performing at the Elbow Room in Jack London Square tomorrow night. Team includes Janae Darden, Precious Green, Lisa Morehouse, True Gwynn, Marissa Ortega-Welch, and Sarah Lai Sterland. Our engineers are James Rollins, Tariq Foda, and Gabe Graben. Content manager is Shireen Adil. Our managing editor is David Boyer. Deputy news director is Angela Johnston. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.